I always wonder what Klingon leisure wear would be like. You know, you always see Klingon uniforms, but do they have like Klingon like summer shorts, you know?
Open collars. Right. Gold medallion.
Exactly.
I could totally see Worf with a open collar gold medallion.
Do they have like chainmail shorts or something?
This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to Episode 7 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be discussing Klingon virtue ethics. Well, Mike, welcome to Episode 7 of Metatrex.
Lucky 7, here we are.
It's hard to believe it's been 7 episodes already, actually.
I know.
It seems like just yesterday we were recording Episode 1, and here we are in Episode 7.
Seems like yesterday we were recording Episode 0.1.
We did have to do a few preliminary episodes before we could bring Metatrex to fruition.
Yeah, that was fun.
But here we are in Episode 7, and for this episode, I thought we could pick up where we left off last time. Last time, if you remember, we were talking about consequentialist ethics and deontological or rule-based ethics in Star Trek. But the other big category of ethical theories that we left out was virtue ethics. So, we were commenting at the end of the last episode that the Klingons are an excellent example of virtue ethics, a totally different approach to ethics rather than focusing on the consequences of actions or focusing on intrinsically right or wrong actions. Klingons have a totally different approach to ethics, so it seemed like a natural segue to start talking about Klingon virtue ethics.
Yeah, I'm anticipating a lot of fun when we think about Klingon virtue ethics. You know, it's so polar opposite of what you and I would probably consider virtuous, but nonetheless, they do live by a very specific code, and I think they are an excellent example, albeit an extreme one.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to diving into that topic here in a few minutes. But before we dive in, I thought we could spend a few minutes just talking about a couple of days ago, I went to a local Star Trek convention here in Sacramento. I'm from Vacaville, California, near the Bay Area, just about 30 miles away from Sacramento. And I found out at the last minute there was a fairly small Star Trek convention happening just up the road in Sacramento. So I drove to that. It was called SAC Trek, S-A-C Trek. And thankfully, I found out that Tim Russ was going to be there. And so I got a chance to listen to a very intimate, small performance where Tim Russ basically did a vocal and guitar solo. And I got to sit in the second row and listen to Tim Russ serenade me on his guitar. It was really a treat being able to listen to his music, especially after corresponding with him a little bit and after he took the time to record that very, very lovely audio bumper intro to our show that you hear at the beginning of the show each week. I wanted to at least be able to meet him and say thank you for recording that for us while he was there. And I got a chance to meet him, and I bought a couple of his CDs and got to listen to a couple songs. So that in itself was really satisfying. It was actually a really small Star Trek convention. It was a gaming / Doctor Who / Star Trek convention in one, and it was a really, really small affair. But there's a local Star Trek club in Sacramento, and they were organizing the event, and I think they had a little trouble getting the word out, but there's potential there for that to become one of the more important Star Trek conventions if it gets a little more attention next year. They had the seeds of a good convention there. They had an interesting panel on women in Star Trek. It's a shame the Women at Warp panelists, Women at Warp podcasters weren't there. It's also I should say, too, I met the Axanar people, Alec Peters and Diana Kingsbury. They were there from Axanar, and they had a great booth set up showing the Prelude to Axanar short movie on Blu-ray. And I'd only seen it on YouTube, and it looked phenomenal on Blu-ray.
Awesome. That is awesome.
So if people haven't taken the time to pick up Prelude to Axanar, try to pick it up on Blu-ray and give it a look. It was really, as you're walking down this, you know, the list of tables, you know, what they were calling the artist tables, you know, people who are producing new content in one variety or another, you know, by far Axanar stole the show. That Prelude to Axanar production looks phenomenal on Blu-ray, and they had a nice big screen TV set up, and they were had it on loop, and it really got a lot of attention as people were walking by.
Yeah, Alec and all the folks associated with Axanar have just done a phenomenal job on that project, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they, you know, what they come up with next.
And of course, we should say too that Trek FM hosts the official Axanar podcast. So if you haven't taken a listen to that yet, be sure to you know, cue that up. Look for the Axanar podcast, and you'll find it elsewhere on Trek FM.
Yeah. Actually, I will say that it's a wonderful look into what it takes to pull off an independent project like Axanar. They have really just kind of step by step. They've brought in some of the writers. They've brought in the directors. They've brought in the production folks and had conversations with them about what they're putting into it. So definitely stop by there and check that out at Trek FM.
And you can actually kind of think of Axanar as a reaction against J.J. Abrams' Trek. You know, they really want to produce some Star Trek that is a little more philosophically rich than what you might see, what we saw in the Abrams universe. And so Alec Peters and I had a nice chance to sit and talk about Star Trek and philosophy, and thankfully he wants to come on our show. So sometime in the next few weeks, we can look forward to having Alec Peters join us on Metatreks to talk about Axanar and Star Trek and philosophy in general.
Yeah, Alec has definitely helped to lead the charge of a higher level of independent productions when it comes to Star Trek. I'm really looking forward to not only Axanar, but you mentioned Tim Russ being at SAC Trek, Renegades. I'm really looking forward to him taking that to the next level. There's also, you know, Tommy Kraft's production, Horizon, looking forward to that, Pacific 201. There's some really, really great independent projects coming out. So all of the folks that are salivating, waiting for January 2017, there's a lot of great productions out there. I just really encourage you to check them out and support them.
Yeah, it occurred to me as I watch various fan-made movies, it reveals to me how complex the formula really is to produce quality, professional-level content. You not only need good writing, you need good directing, you need good acting, you need to have good visual production, you know, and if you're missing any one of these elements, it shows. And I think, you know, the various fan-made productions out there excel or fail to excel on any one of these axes. And, you know, producing, you know, canonical, professional quality Star Trek really is a magic formula of these different elements, and when those elements are missing, there's something falls flat, and it makes me appreciate that much more the production value you get in a professionally produced product, and the money and resources and time and dedication and quality protection checking that you have to do in order to produce something of that level of quality.
Yeah, you were talking earlier about Tim Russ's performance. You want to say anything more about how that went?
Well, you know, I think it was fascinating because the contrast between for me, you know, I'm actually fairly new to convention going. I haven't spent years going to conventions. You know, seeing someone I've seen on TV, you know, for all these years, you know, in the role of Tuvok with the mannerisms and demeanor and whatnot. There's a contrast between, you know, Tim Russ on TV as playing Tuvok and Tim Russ the musician, you know, dressed very casually with different mannerisms because he's not acting, he's being himself, and right? He's still performing, but he's, you know, doing his own music. Just Tim Russing and a guitar with some pre-recorded background music. It was casual, it was intimate, it was you know, he played a variety of songs, some of which were his own, some of which were covers of other bands' music. But he played maybe 10 songs. I don't know the exact number. I can't remember. But just the contrast between Tuvok on Voyager and Tim Russ, the musician, playing his own music, dressed very informally, was a stark contrast for me. And I got a much better sense of seeing Tim Russ the person versus Tim Russ the actor on Voyager. And of course, you know, that's what you would expect. At a convention, you know, we're not watching Star Trek, we're meeting the actors in real life, so to speak, IRL.
Yeah, and I I tend not to forget, you know, that these folks are actors. I know there are some fans out there who have a difficulty separating the person from the character. I'm not one of those people, but on the same hand, Tim plays such an iconic character in the Star Trek universe, and for all intents and purposes, one of my most beloved characters. I'm having a difficult time wrapping my brain around Tuvok with a guitar, you know, kind of jamming. I'm having a difficult time seeing that. I'm sort of, my visual picture, Zachary, is that scene when Neelix was leaving Voyager and Tuvok danced air quotes for him. I'm that's what I'm kind of seeing. Tim Russ with a guitar and doing that little foot move.
Right. Well, the thing is, you know, it really was a rocking show. You know, he's a great musician, and it shows when he was performing. But it was a fairly small audience, and you know, the audience needed to be loosened up a little bit. I was trying to get everyone to clap along with the music and you know, loosen up and dance a little bit. And you know, it was still kind of a short, small gathering. But he was a great musician. It was fun to watch him play. I enjoyed the show thoroughly.
Yeah, and he's a great guy, just a great guy. And I just want to say again, thank you so much, Tim. If you happen to be listening for the audio bumper, you're a class act, a gentleman, and we appreciate you.
Absolutely. And an open invitation to be on our podcast. Tim, if you ever want to come talk Star Trek and philosophy with us, you have an open invitation to join us on MetaTrex.
Indeed, that would be ethical.
I should say too, Mike, you should be keeping your eye on your mailbox. There should be something arriving in your mailbox anytime, something from SacTrek.
I'm very excited about that.
I'm not telling you what it is, but a little surprise for you straight from Sacramento.
Thank you, buddy.
No problem.
All right, shall we?
Happy to deliver.
Shall we dive in?
Absolutely. So, like we said at the beginning of the show, we're going to talk about Klingon virtue ethics today. But before we do that, let's get just a quick overview of virtue ethics in general and what makes it a distinctive approach to ethics from the consequentialist ethics and rule-based deontological ethics that we talked about last week. So, I'll go ahead and dive in and just give an overview. Basically, virtue ethics is one of the three big categories of types of ethical theories. The first two that we talked about last week are consequentialist ethics, which emphasizes the consequences of an action. So according to that view, if you want to decide what actions are right or wrong, you basically decide which actions are going to maximize overall good consequences and minimize overall bad consequences. We also talked about deontological ethics, which is a rule-based ethics. And that view basically holds that some actions are intrinsically right or intrinsically wrong, regardless of the consequences that stem from those actions. We talked about Kantian ethics, and we spent a lot of time analyzing the DS9 episode In the Pale Moonlight from the perspective of consequentialism and the perspective of deontological or rule-based ethics. And, you know, I was listening to that episode just this morning, actually, as we're preparing that episode for release. I was listening to the final edit of that show, and that was a really fun discussion we had last week, Mike. I think it was maybe one of the better discussions we've had on MetaTrex yet so far. We really analyzed the heck out of In the Pale Moonlight using consequentialism and deontological ethics as our two viewpoints, our two perspectives to analyze that episode. But we did observe at the end of the episode that we left out the third major category of ethical theory is virtue ethics. And what makes virtue ethics a distinctive type of ethical theory is the fact that it emphasizes character traits over actions. Both of the other two theories, consequentialism and deontological ethics, mainly focus on actions, right? Consequentialism is trying to decide which actions are right or wrong based on the consequences, and rule-based ethics is trying to decide which actions are intrinsically right or intrinsically wrong, or which rules for action do we adopt as a society. But virtue ethics focuses on character traits and cultivating character traits that we think of as virtuous, and emphasizing aspects of individual people, right? Character traits, which are attributes of people, not attributes of actions. So we observed at the end of the last episode that the Klingons are a great example of virtue ethics, because there's always this emphasis when the Klingons are on screen of Klingons trying to be a true Klingon, a quote-unquote true Klingon warrior, right? And so these are, the Klingons to me seem to embrace the idea that what matters more than the actions that they do, what matters more than the consequences of their actions, what matters to them is being a true Klingon warrior in some way. Mm-hmm. And so I thought we could spend some time diving into the minutiae of what it means to be a true Klingon warrior from the perspective of virtue ethics.
Yeah, very interesting. When we talk about Klingon virtue ethics, I think about Kern in Sins of the Father. He said, you know, Klingon's honor means more to him than life. You know, means more to him than his life. So there's definitely definitely a great conversation to be had there when we're talking about what it is that's important to a Klingon. You know, what is it that he values above everything else? Well, according to Kern, it's his honor.
Before we dive in to talk about Klingons, we should probably spend a little bit of time talking about the traditional virtue ethics theories that are out there. Most of the talk of virtue ethics comes from Aristotle, who basically held that what matters to be a virtuous person is to cultivate good habits of action. It's more like training, more like maybe learning to play the piano, you know, sort of training yourself out of the bad habits, training yourself into the good habits, and cultivating habits of action that lead to being a virtuous character. And so some of the concepts that are associated with this virtue approach to ethics are things like, you might have heard the phrase the golden mean or the golden average. Mm-hmm. Aristotle had this view that what mattered to be a virtuous person, you need to find sort of the golden sweet spot between two opposing vices. And the example that's always used is the example of courage, right? What does it mean to be a courageous person? Well, it's really the middle ground between two opposing vices, a vice of excess and a vice of deficiency. You know, the vice of excess would be being overly courageous to the point of being foolhardy or making foolish choices, being reckless, right? A vice of deficiency might be being cowardice, right? Not having enough courage and being a coward. But courage for Aristotle is kind of the middle ground between these two opposing vices. But the important thing for virtue ethics is that it's not a matter of individual actions and deciding whether individual actions are right or wrong. It's about being a courageous person for Aristotle. And there's different traditions of virtue ethics that stem from that view. There are Aristotle had this view that there are four cardinal virtues, things like courage and wisdom and temperance and justice. Mm-hmm. Those are called the cardinal virtues, the most important virtues. But again, these are character traits. Courage is a character trait. It's not a trait of an individual action. Wisdom is a character trait. It's not a trait of an individual action. And so the important thing for virtue ethics is to decide which character traits or which attributes are most important, which result in a virtuous life. And as I think about this in Star Trek, of course, you can ask this question of any different race or any different role in Star Trek. You can ask yourself, what does it mean to be a virtuous Federation citizen? What does it mean to be a virtuous Klingon? What does it mean to be a virtuous starship captain? And these are, it's interesting to ask whether there's some overlap, you know, are there universal character traits or are character traits somehow relative to the individual cultures? And, you know, Klingons are so interesting because they're a radical departure from Federation values, right? There's a whole Klingon warrior culture that leads to some actions like, you know, killing your superior to take his place, right? That's something that's okay in Klingon society.
And that's perfectly normal.
Yeah, that's part of being a Klingon warrior. That's a Klingon virtue, right? And that's so different than the ethical judgments you get in the Federation or in Starfleet. I think it's an interesting kind of test case to look into virtue ethics and ask the question, are there any universally virtuous character traits, or in Star Trek, are virtuous character traits somehow relative to race or culture?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Aristotle's golden mean, and anytime I think about the golden mean, I have this almost uncontrollable impulse to start drawing Venn diagrams. You've got two opposing views and you want to be in the sweet spot there in the middle.
See, Mike, I thought Tim Rest serenading me with a guitar was music to my ears, but when people start talking about Venn diagrams, that is music to my ears.
Indeed. Yeah, but, you know, the interesting thing here, when we talk about the Klingons in Star Trek and, you know, virtue ethics, and we contrast that with Starfleet, you do have, right, two very opposing opinions, ideas about what is ethical. And sometimes they overlap. Sometimes you can find commonalities. In fact, I think Worf is a great character study in what it means to kind of merge those two almost seemingly opposing positions in terms of ethics. And I think sometimes it's what causes Worf as a character to almost idealize sometimes what it means to be a Klingon, because his sense of ethics, his sense of what it is to be Klingon, is somewhat tainted, if you will, by his experience being raised by humans and, you know, being a part of Starfleet Academy and, you know, serving on a Starfleet vessel.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Worf because, you know, like you said, Worf is kind of the odd man out when you're talking about Klingons, right? On the one hand, he is a Klingon and he has some experience, and he wasn't born right into the Federation, right? He was born into the Klingon Empire, but as at a young age, he was adopted by human parents. And yet, because of that, he has this internal identity crisis, right? He desperately wants to be a Klingon, and he's clearly taken the time to understand what it means to be a Klingon, right? He's done his homework. It's not like he's totally ignorant of what it means to be a Klingon, right? In fact, he values it so much. He seems to know everything about it. He knows every ritual. He knows every term, right? He can drop them left and right. But at the same time, you know, Worf kind of has this idealized sense of what it means to be a Klingon because he hasn't experienced the practical day-to-day reality of being a Klingon and seeing how other Klingons actually do interact with each other and how they function in life. So it's an interesting question. Can you look to Worf as an example for what it means to be an ideal Klingon, or what it means to be a Klingon? You know, are Worf's emphases and Worf's choices and Worf's perspective on what it means to be a Klingon, is that something that's representative of Klingons as a whole? And I think the answer is plausibly no, right? So for me, I think if you're trying to understand Klingon culture and Klingon virtues, then we need to look not just at Worf and not just at say, B'Elanna Torres and Voyager. We need to look at the other Klingon episodes, you know, look at actual Klingons mm-hmm. besides Worf who are deeply steeped in the reality of being a Klingon and see what we can learn about Klingon virtues from those characters, not just from Worf.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we talk about Worf observing him as the ideal Klingon, I think probably if Worf were sitting here right now and we were asking him, what does it mean to be the ideal Klingon? I think, interestingly, Zachary, he probably wouldn't point to himself. We see his character every time a Klingon is inserted into the storyline. He's almost like a child looking for a father figure. One of the episodes that you and I talked about last week in the Turbo Lift on the way out of the show, Heart of Glory. And I think about, you know, those three Klingons coming onto the Enterprise, Commander Chorus, played by Vaughn Armstrong, who I think next to Jeffrey Combs is probably one of the best character actors in the Star Trek universe, but that I digress. When Chorus comes onto the Enterprise, Worf just, I mean, he's right on him. You know, he's like a child who's looking for this kind of father figure. And you can see that he is a sponge wanting to take in what it means to be a Klingon. And Chorus was really, as far as what we can see, Chorus was really one of the first influences on him. You could see that desire to attain, you know, his Klingon nature. And we see that carried all the way through to, you know, when we get him to Deep Space Nine and we have Martok coming into the story. And they literally become, it's kind of a father and son sort of relationship, but really they're kind of brothers in terms of their relationship. So we see how Martok really helped Worf, I think probably more than anyone, understand what it means to be a true Klingon.
Well, like you, I rewatched Heart of Glory before we recorded tonight. And, you know, it's a season one Next Generation episode. And so it's really not a great episode in a lot of ways. You know, it has all the flaws you might expect of any first season TNG episode. But what jumped out at me, and this is actually what got me thinking about Klingons as an example of virtue ethics in general, is that many times throughout Worf's storyline, various Klingons challenge Worf's authenticity as a Klingon, right? They want to know whether he's still a Klingon warrior. Does the fire battle, the lust for battle still sort of, you know, burn inside his veins, or has he gone soft and you know, because of his life in the Federation and in Starfleet? And so, you know, that happens in Heart of Glory, and he's challenged by his own brother, right? Kern challenges him in this regard. It happens several other times that we could probably brainstorm if we really tried. And this this got me thinking that what matters most to Klingons is being a Klingon, right? You know, it's not enough to be Klingon by blood. There are some character traits that are involved in being a Klingon, and this seems to matter much more than any of the actual what we normally think of as ethical actions, right? Do you murder or not murder? Do you steal or do you not steal? The types of things that we talked about in the last episode of Metatrex when we talked about consequentialism and deontological ethics. Those types of considerations just seem not to matter as much for Klingons. The first and foremost consideration for them is, are you a true Klingon or have you gone soft?
Yeah, indeed. You know, when we were talking about Aristotle and these character traits, these virtues, one of the terms that I associate probably most often with virtue ethics is a Greek term. And depending on your school of thought, you may pronounce it differently. Eudaimonos. Some people pronounce it with an H, which is absolutely wrong. But you know, there are several ways. Eudaimonia,
I think philosophers tend to call it eudaimonia, which is kind of a bastardized pronunciation of it. But yeah,
yeah. And this is a compound word. The first part of that word is good or happy, and daimonos or daimonia, that is a word that means spirit. So we're thinking about the end goal of these virtues being, you know, a happy spirit, you know, finding that inner happiness, finding that that place where you find personal fulfillment. And you know what strikes me as interesting is what it takes for a Klingon to find personal fulfillment. And again, we go back to, you know, Kern, a Klingon's honor means more to him than his life. Sometimes it's dying. You know, I think about, you know, Klingon's fixation with a good death, dying well. That was in Heart of Glory. That was one of the questions that was asked of Worf, you know, Commander Chorus, did he die well? Did he die good? And, you know, Worf answered yes. You know, he died a warrior. And that was something valuable to them. They didn't want him to rot away in a jail or to be executed or, you know, to die well, to die a warrior with his batleth in his hand. That's a virtue that leads to a happy being.
It's interesting that you mentioned the term eudaimonia, which actually comes from Aristotle himself. He, as far as I know, he's the first person to use that term in a virtue ethics type of sense. But for Aristotle, you know, the highest goal is this term eudaimonia or happiness. And maybe the English word happiness doesn't quite have the right connotation, but basically you might translate it as something like living well. What does living well mean for humans? And for Aristotle, it means a few things. It means sort of living in the middle between two extremes, right? If you go too much of an extreme, if you're too cowardice or you're too courageous, that's not being a virtuous person. That's not living well. So for Aristotle, it had this connotation of kind of trying to stay in the middle, avoiding the extremes. It also had the connotation of developing towards your natural ends. Aristotle had this view that all things in nature, including human beings, develop towards their natural ends. Just like an acorn develops into an oak tree, you might say the oak tree is the natural end of an acorn. Everything in nature, for Aristotle, tends to progress towards its ends. And Aristotle has this view that humans are what you might call rational political animals, right? When humans are using their reason well, when humans are functioning well in a political society, solving practical problems together, through political dialogue. These are the kinds of things that lead to an individual living well and progressing to its natural ends, but also lead towards society functioning well and progressing towards its natural end as a polis, a cosmopolitan political society for Aristotle. So the interesting question for me, you know, and let's see what that means for Klingons. Is the highest goal for Klingons sort of personal fulfillment, as you put it? You know, I think one misreading of Aristotle might be happiness as personal fulfillment or eudaimonia as personal fulfillment. Really, it means more like living well. So, you know, if it's something more like happiness or individual fulfillment, that doesn't seem to capture the heart of being a Klingon for me, because Klingons are more than willing to, for the sake of duty and honor, to perform what I would call self-sacrificing kinds of actions, right? Klingons are noble in a way too, despite their warlike, samurai-like warrior code. They prioritize duty, they prioritize honor, they're willing to sacrifice themselves for their families or for the sake of the Klingon Empire. And that doesn't necessarily strike me as personal fulfillment. fulfillment. If anything, it strikes me more like self-sacrifice, but it still could mean living well. So eudaimonia in some broader sense, this idea of living well, could still apply to Klingons. So I'm curious how much of Aristotle's idea of living well for humans really kind of overlaps with what it means to live well as a Klingon, or if they're really two different things.
Yeah, because when I think of Klingons, I don't think of them as being so fixated on living well so much as they're fixated, as I said previously, to dying well. That seems to be what they're most interested in, dying well. I think about, that warrior ethic, that warrior spirit that they have that runs so deep, that I can't think of the episode off the top of my head, but they're having a civil war, and these rivals, they meet to drink, and they're equals, and they have this period of time where after the battle they're just kind of hanging out in the bar drinking and right. growling at each other and wrestling and snarling and this loud revelry. And Worf is appalled by that because, again, he's tainted by his experience with the Federation. You don't hang out and drink and snarl and hang out with your enemy. We're at war here.
Well, but before the show, I actually wrote down a list of some questions we might ask. And one of the questions is, what is the highest good or goal for a Klingon warrior, right? If just like for Aristotle is asking the questions about humans, what is the highest good or the goal of a human life? What is the highest good or goal of a Klingon warrior? What are your thoughts on that, Mike?
I think that has actually been answered several times, throughout their appearances in many of the Star Trek episodes, and it seems like it is always, to serve the Empire, to bring honor to the Empire. That seems to be, at least for what we would call a virtuous Klingon, that's his ultimate goal, to serve and to bring honor to the Empire. I think about Sons and Daughters, when Worf's son comes back into the picture after living with his parents for many years, and there's Worf, first officer, on a Klingon vessel, and there stands his son, and his son is asked, what are you doing here? What is it you want to do? What's your goal? And he simply says, to serve the Empire. I think that's a very Klingon answer, to that question. What's your purpose in life? To serve the Empire. That's a very Klingon answer. I think that is the answer.
Well, there's something a little paradoxical. You mentioned this a second ago, that maybe the goal of a Klingon life is to die well, right? To die in the line of duty, to die serving the Empire, to die in glorious battle, right? These are things that are associated with a Klingon life. But I'm thinking back to the discussion we had last week about Kant and deontological ethics. Remember, one of the features of Kant's ethical view was to ask the question, what if everyone lived that way, right? What if this standard, whatever it is the universal standard for action? Is there something paradoxical about the idea of a Klingon life being geared towards death? If the highest goal of Klingon living is to die, is there something kind of life undercutting, not life affirming about that? In other words, is there something kind of nihilistic or something almost suicidal about the Klingon drive towards dying a good death?
Well, interestingly enough, they are very nihilistic. Warriors and their families, for that matter. I mean, they believe that death is an experience best shared, they view it as this joyful time. I mean, you think about what I call a joyful time, getting together and celebrating with friends. A Klingon, on the other hand, you're not going to see a bunch of Klingons hanging around eating cake and laughing at
unless it's a peptide cake with mint frosting.
Peptide cake, indeed. But I think about the episode Blood Oath. These three great Klingon warriors come together, and they're going on a quest to hunt down this albino that they have, they have an issue with. We won't get into the particulars of the episode for time's sake, but here they are coming together to share the experience of death. They don't think, Zachary, there is any chance and Stovall Corps that they are going to be able to come out of this alive. But yet, here they are. They've come together. This is going to be their last great quest, and they're going to die together in honor. You know, and they celebrate that. They celebrate the release of the death spirit. You know, rather than grieving over what they consider to be an empty shell, they celebrate, you know, death. It's something that's honorable. It's something that, you know, even a kamikaze-like suicide, you know, that takes the enemy with it. That's an honorable thing. On the other hand, dying of old age or dying of some disease, especially something terminal, that's not honorable. You know, that's not ethical. They would rather go out in a blaze of glory.
Yeah, I think, like you said, despite the emphasis on dying a good death, the Klingons at the same time are some of the most life-affirming beings that you see in Star Trek, right? You know, they not only do they celebrate a good death, there's this almost a joyfulness to it, right? If you happen to die in glorious battle, other people will celebrate. If you don't die in glorious battle, it wasn't a good day to die, and you might as well, you know, celebrate with some blood wine anyway. despite this sort of, I worry a bit because it sounds a little, you know, sort of existentially nihilistic, right? If the goal of life is to die, you know, from a Kantian standpoint or from a human standpoint, that sounds rather dark to me, but at the same time, Klingons are most able to live in the moment, way more than humans, I think, right? You know, Klingons are because you do see them drinking blood wine and celebrating in the moment, they're some of the most life-affirming beings that you see. You know, after death, they'll celebrate. In the moment, they're going to celebrate. And they do kind of live in the moment, I think, more than other races do in Star Trek. What do you think about that?
Yeah, for sure. They are life-affirming, but there again, I think about, you know, Deep Space Nine, when they took Cardassia, the agreement was between Sisko, Ross, and General Martok, when they took Cardassia, they were going to, you know, they were going to toast blood wine. And there they are, they're surrounded by death, and Martok is in the height of his glory. I mean, he pours that blood wine, and he drinks it with gusto, and there's Sisko and Ross looking at each other in utter disgust at the loss of life, you know, the carnage that's just laying all around them. They pour their blood wine out in disgust. And Martok, I'll never forget, you know, Martok looks at them like, you know, what idiots? Oh, well, you know, and he just takes another drink. There is that. They are life-affirming, but I think more than affirming life, it's about, you know, duty and honor and in the end, dying well.
Well, think of the contrast between Klingons and Vulcans, right? Vulcans are rational, logical beings that tend to deny the physical reality of their situation, right? If it's not Ponfar, in other words, they're not embracing the physicality of their being, right? They live essentially a mental existence, almost in some sort of Cartesian dualist standpoint, right? Vulcans think of themselves as fundamentally logical beings, not necessarily physical beings in the physical reality with physical drives and desires and needs and wants and the like. That's not who the Vulcans are. They deny those things, maybe until Ponfar rolls around.
Klingons, on the other hand, are very carnal.
Yeah, exactly. The contrast between Klingons and Vulcans here is interesting, right? For a Klingon, Klingons are essentially physical beings, right? They will drink to fulfillment, right? And in every single moment, they are willing to entertain the carnality or the physicality of their situation, right? And that is just a very different view of themselves than other races like the Vulcans have.
Yeah, I think about Killar and the viewpoint that she had. I mean, she was half human, but she looked at this as Klingon nonsense. These were dumb ideas about honor to her. I think about her point of view. I would have liked to have seen them be able to explore her character a little bit more. I would have liked to have been able to see the Klingon people from her perspective, because I think she brought a really interesting perspective, because she was around Klingons, but she was also half human. So she had other ideas about their sense of honor. And her perspective, I think, was very interesting, what little bit we got to see.
Yeah, she's kind of the prototype for B'Elanna Torres, as I think about it, right? I mean, she is Klingon, and she seems to embrace some Klingon virtues and values, but she largely thinks of the Klingon stuff as, you know, quote-unquote, as nonsense, right? Mm-hmm. And just like B'Elanna Torres does. And we've observed before on Metatrex that some of these characters that are of two worlds, like Worf is of two worlds, K'Lar is of two worlds, she's half Klingon, right? That creates some of the dramatic tension for those characters, right? If you're sense of who you are and the virtues you should cultivate and the goals for your life are pulled in two radically different directions, that's going to be an interesting character inherently. So for me, characters like Worf and B'Elanna are some of the most interesting characters, just because they are the characters that are forced very explicitly to deal with the question, who am I? What kind of being am I going to be? Because they have a choice, right? They could go the human direction. They could go the Klingon direction. And, you know, so many people don't, I'm going to wax poetic here a little bit maybe, but so many people don't take the time to think about what kind of being they want to be. They just accept life as it comes, accept their character traits as who they are. Mm-hmm. It's interesting psychologically and it's interesting philosophically to turn your attention inward and say, you know, what kind of life do I want to live? What kinds of character traits define me as an individual or define me as part of my society or part of my race, whatever it is, right? How many people don't take the time to ask those questions and just let society as a whole answer those questions for them? Characters like Worf have to ask the question, what virtues do I find important? Which Klingon virtues am I going to adopt? Which am I going to reject? And which human virtues, if you were a Ferengi, right? Which human virtues are you going to adopt, which you're going to reject? And if you want to pick and choose, pick a few Klingon virtues and pick a few human virtues, how do I synthesize them together into something that's uniquely me, right? Worf, in a few places in Star Trek says, you know, I know the Klingon way, but that's not my way. And I'm going to do things my way this time, you know, and being able to synthesize those opposing views and those opposing virtues together into something that's a unique individual is an inherent part of what it means to be those characters. And that's why Worf is probably my favorite character in Star Trek. He has to deal with that more than most other characters, maybe besides Spock.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that makes Worf such an interesting example of a Klingon is, let's face it, I mean, he got most of his understanding of his people from, I don't know where, reading. It came out of a book. So,
well, that's a good question because Worf seems to know an awful lot about what it means to be a Klingon, right? I mean, he has every ritual down pat, even the really obscure rituals that come up in very specific situations. Is he literally just have like the Klingon virtue ethics manual? Does the Klingon guide to maybe like the Klingon version of an etiquette manual, right? The Klingon Emily Post.
Yeah.
is that what Worf reads when he goes to bed at night? Or, you know, what is his source? Because he clearly doesn't have much interaction with other Klingons. So he's not getting it from aunts and uncles or cousins. He's not getting it from, you know, his friends who are Klingons. He's got to be getting it out of, out of a future book.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, other Klingons tell him, you know, you don't know anything about Klingons, Worf. In Deep Space Nine, you know, he looking for Pamak in all the wrong places. You know, he's fixated on this Klingon woman and her, her bodyguard in essence kind of pulls him aside and says, you know, come on, Worf, do you know anything about courting a Klingon woman? Look, you're out of your league. You don't know what you're getting into. So walk away.
Well, I was reflecting on how Worf tries to characterize being a Klingon, and Worf seems to use this phrase that comes up again and again. It'll be something like, Klingons do not fill in the blank, right? And Worf says this many times. Klingons do not laugh. Klingons do not, you know, whatever. You got a few of these, Mike? Can you remember any specific ones? I remember Klingons do not laugh, and then Guinan has to correct him. She says, no, I've heard lots of Klingons laugh. You don't laugh, Worf. Klingons have laughs that'll make your toes curl. But what other things does Worf say? Because he drops this a lot of the time. Yeah. You know, Klingons do not whatever.
Klingons do not beg.
Klingons do not beg. You know, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I can come up with any more off the top of my head. But, and of course, naturally, I can't remember any of them right now. But that's the thing. These phrases sound like they came out of a book, right? The Klingon training manual. Klingons do not. I don't know. What's another one? What are some things Klingons just wouldn't do?
Well, yeah, I think the interesting thing here, you know, we talk about where he gets his knowledge of Klingons. Obviously, probably not from other Klingons. So, you know, somewhere out there, and I think about Kalis kind of being his example of what it is. Kalis is the ultimate Klingon. And let's face it, this is, Kalis is almost a deity in the Klingon culture. He's very revered, much like, Jesus Christ is to the Christian. And I don't know, is there perhaps a Klingon gospel out there where, you know, Kalis is sitting on a mountaintop and, you know, he delivers, you know, his beatitudes, you know, instead of blessed are the poor in spirit or blessed are the peacemakers, you know, Kalis says, Klingons do not beg. Klingons do not laugh. Klingon. I don't know.
It's interesting you mentioned the notion of an ideal Klingon, because one tradition in virtue ethics is to have this notion of an ideal human. Aristotle had a concept like that. Augustine and Aquinas, who also had this Aristotelian virtue ethics view of humankind, had this notion of an ideal man. And of course, in Christian virtue ethics, you get Jesus as the example of an ideal human, someone to be emulated, mm-hmm. right? The prototypical example of the virtues that are to be cultivated and emulated. And obviously for Klingons, Kalis would be that, would serve that role in Klingon virtue ethics, right? Kalis is the ideal Klingon, the one individual that all Klingons look to as an example of what it means to be a virtuous Klingon, to be a true Klingon. So what can we learn from that? I think, clearly Kalis is a different kind of messianic figure than Jesus in Christianity, right? So they don't seem to typify the same virtues, but it's interesting that they both have a sense of an ideal person, an ideal individual. And so I might try to think of it in terms of, it's almost a Platonic ideal, right? You know, if you want to cultivate a virtue, it's natural to think, well, what does it mean to have these virtues to the maximum degree, right? What does it mean to be the most ideal, the most loving, the most kind, the most charitable individual? And not to mix this up with theology too much, because you know that's not really the topic for today. But you know, in theology, you know, it's common to think of God as having the supreme attribute of the supreme degree of those attributes, right?
Sure.
The most, you know, the being that's omnipotent and omnibenevolent and omniscient, mm-hmm. right? So what's the Klingon equivalent? It's Kalis, but what are those attributes that makes Kalis the ideal Klingon?
Yeah, and that's interesting because they never really get into that. In fact, when Kalis is cloned and Worf comes face to face with him, he's almost to some degree disappointed, because even Kalis, or you know, maybe we should say this properly, Kalis's clone didn't even quite live up to Worf's ideal image of Kalis and who he would be. So, you know, what are those attributes that makes Kalis who Kalis is? I don't know, other than the fact that, you know, he killed a lot of people.
Well, okay, this is interesting though, because just because people can't live up to an ideal doesn't necessarily invalidate the ideal, right? There's a lot of, I mean, hell, I've met a lot of them, right? I grew up as a Christian going to churches, and I met a lot of people that were really terrible examples of what it means to be a Christian, right? Not that there's any good ones, but necessarily, but you know what I'm saying, right? The fact that people can't live up to an individual, to an ideal, doesn't mean that the ideal isn't necessarily valid. So what can we learn about Worf's disappointment about Kalis, right? From the fact that even Kalis, the clone of Kalis, can't live up to the ideal of Kalis, does that mean that those Klingon ideals aren't anything to shoot for anymore? Or does it somehow undermine his faith in the ideals? Or does it sort of still, does it retain the sense that the ideals are something to shoot for, even though no one can live up to them?
Yeah.
Even Kalis himself.
Yeah. And you know, it's easy for me sitting on this side with my own sense of virtue and my own sense of ethics. And I can look at Worf and say, you know, he really is the answer for all that's wrong with the Klingon people, because he does, in many ways, marry the two schools of thought, the two philosophies, in something that I think truly is honorable. His ideal that he is that he is striving for, I think, is something that's truly honorable. And I think first of all, it's what makes him a great character, but I also believe that it's what has earned him the respect of both Federation and Klingon alike. I mean, after all, General Martok gets to know him and just admires him. You know, any Klingon that's worth his salt sees in Worf that ideal, that greatness that Worf is looking for in other Klingons. And so it's easy for me to sit here and say, you know, Worf really is the ideal Klingon, but he really isn't in terms of, you know, what is a true Klingon.
Well, in a way, there's a parallel between Worf and Socrates, the philosopher, right? Because Worf is in the position of constantly being the one to point out the inconvenient truths about the hypocrisy of other Klingons, right? Worf is the one who's often in a position of saying, you know, to other Klingons, you use the word honor, but it doesn't have any meaning. Mm. You're doing these dishonorable actions while you're talking about it in terms of honor and loyalty and duty and not really living up to the standard. So in a very interesting way that I just thought of right now, Worf is maybe the Socrates, a gadfly who is stinging other Klingons into seeing their own hypocrisy.
Let's see, Worfertees.
Yeah, right. You know, will future Klingons look to Worf as the ideal Klingon?
It's quite possible. It's quite possible.
It's an interesting thought.
You know, one thing I will say, when we talk about the Klingons as a nihilistic society, one of the things that I do admire about Klingons that is very contrast to what we see from the Federation and perhaps other species in Star Trek is that Klingons usually mate for life. You know, morally, they live by a very strict moral code. And that becomes a sense of conflict for Worf on a couple of occasions because he takes that mating bond, you know, pretty seriously. Kellar didn't, and you know, certainly Jadzia wasn't sure about it early on. So I see that, and I see that virtue. I see that you know, that high sense of morality. These are a noble people. In fact, you know, Riker, after spending, I don't know, was it even a day he spent on a Klingon ship? And funny enough, you know, Worf's giving him all kinds of advice as they're going to the, you know, transporter room. And because he knows so much about Klingons, right? So Riker goes and he spends maybe a day with Klingons and he comes back and he tells Worf, you know, you come from a, you know, wonderful, noble people. And he got bruises on his cheek. And
the question that came to my mind while you were talking just now is whether we're placing Klingons in the right category. You know, when we started recording tonight, my hypothesis had been that Klingons are a good example of virtue ethics, right? That character, whatever that means, whatever these essential Klingon character traits are, matters more to Klingons than individual actions. But the thing you were just describing seemed to emphasize the rule-based aspect of being a Klingon, sort of their samurai warrior code, their nobility, mm-hmm. The notion that they mate for life, that those are rules that they follow, right? There are things you do and don't do as a Klingon. Am I conflating two different things here? In other words, are Klingons really, should they really fall in the category of virtue ethics, or does their nobility and their code of action, code of honor, so to speak, does that put them back in the category of deontological ethics that we talked about last week? Are they more of a rule-based ethics or more of a character-based ethics?
I think they definitely have some rules. I mean, there's a code that they follow, but in terms of their ethics, it's more a matter of personal honor with them. And in some cases, I think I think anything goes as long as it's considered honorable. They can do just about anything, and they do just about anything they want to do, as long as they can even twist it into being something honorable. Yeah, I mean, they do have rules, obviously. I mean, Worf tells Riker, you know, it's your duty as first officer to kill your captain if he becomes weak, and your second will do the same thing to you.
But it seems to me that, you know, as I think about different examples of Klingons and Klingon culture that you see in Star Trek, it seems that whatever rules that exist, they seem to be derivative of Klingon character and Klingon ideals in general, right? It's not that the rules exist for their own sake. They're not going through these sort of rational tap dances that Kant goes through in trying to decide what rules are right or wrong, right? There's a notion of an essential Klingon character, and whatever rules exist are derivative of that notion of Klingon character.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's accurate.
Well, I'm going through my list of other questions to talk about tonight. I thought we could just go through a few more of these. So one question I have is, does anything have intrinsic value for a Klingon? You know, we
a beard.
You don't see any beardless Klingons, so, you know.
No, actually, a beard is a symbol of courage. in the Klingon Empire. So if I were a Klingon, I would be a most courageous one.
So can you list a few things? So, you know, that we talked about some Klingon character traits. What has intrinsic value versus being value, you know, so the question about what has intrinsic value is a question of what things are meaningful for their own sake versus meaningful only to achieve some very specific goal, right? You know, like a hammer is useful if you want to build a house, but it doesn't necessarily have intrinsic value, right? What things are on the Klingon worldview or in terms of Klingon character, what character traits or what things have value for their own sake? Are there any things?
They don't seem to place a lot of they certainly don't place value on material things. Mm-hmm. In fact, Klingons, at least as best we can understand them, are somewhat Spartan. You know, they obviously don't place any value on material things. In fact, most Klingons, I think, value their targ above just about anything else. So a targ, that's all I've got.
Well,
a good
targ. They certainly value individual honor and,
yes,
and all the character traits that go along with that, duty and loyalty and whatnot, right? They're very noble, despite their sort of raw physicality and the violence and, you know, the things that look like negative attributes to humans. There's a sense of duty and honor, the individual duty and honor that is valuable in its own sake for Klingons. They also seem to prioritize the Empire, right? There's some selfless dedication to the Empire as a whole, right? The Empire is going to presumably persist long after individual Klingons have come and gone, right? So, you know, in dying for the Empire survives. So the Empire seems to have intrinsic value, or at least value beyond the scope of an individual life for a Klingon, right? But the Empire matters more than the life of an individual.
It occurs to me, Zachary, that loyalty is something that they place a high value on. Mm-hmm. I can think of a few examples of this. You know, first of all, that is what caused the parting between Gowron and Worf. Gowron felt that Worf was being disloyal to him personally. I mean, it was very personal. I think it had very little to do with the Empire. It had everything to do with, you know, Gowron feeling that Worf owed him something.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Worf wasn't loyal to him, I mean, it just became it led to their, you know, to their final, that final feud, you know, where Worf ultimately kills him in glorious combat in battle. So, you know, that loyalty, I think, is very important. I think of, again, Blood Oath. Jadzia, understanding the Klingon system of virtues and ethics, felt very compelled to be a part of this quest to hunt down this albino. And she felt that it was her duty. She was honor-bound to join these three Klingon warriors in this quest. And so that sense of loyalty, she understood, was something important to her. In fact, it was more important to her than it was the other three Klingons, who were more than willing to, you know, to allow her to take a bye because, you know, she no longer was Curzon Dax, but rather Jadzia Dax. So, and of course, I think the fact that she was a woman probably had something to do with it. They felt that she was, not warrior enough to go on the quest with him. But that, again, I digress. I think that loyalty is something that Klingons put an intrinsic value on.
I'm trying to think of other examples where loyalty comes up for Klingons, and the thing that comes to my mind is, remember the episode when Worf basically calls out his brother on, you know, his brother wants to support the Duras during the Klingon Civil War, and Worf basically calls him out on it, saying, you know, that would be disloyal, right? Gowron is the leader of the Empire, and we owe him our allegiance, we owe him our loyalty, right? That's what it means to be loyal to the Empire, and loyalty can be a sticking point for Klingons. You know, I guess they debate over, you know, which faction you should be most loyal to, or how loyalty should be implemented. But they do seem to have a sense of loyalty in all those situations.
Yeah, I believe that was Sins of the Father. Yes, absolutely.
Yes, that's right. Sins of the Father.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that sense of loyalty. And I think, again, in the relationship that Worf had with Kern, that was oftentimes the conflict between them. You know, Kern's perception that Worf was more loyal to Starfleet and to the uniform that he was wearing than he was to the Empire and even to the House of Moog.
So let me ask you this. So certainly loyalty is a Klingon virtue, but is there anything sort of uniquely Klingon about it, right? Humans have loyalty as a virtue as well, right? You know, Federation citizens and Starfleet officers are loyal to the Federation, loyal to Federation ideals. What is uniquely Klingon about loyalty?
I don't think it is a unique Klingon virtue, at least how I define loyalty. Now, oftentimes we think about loyalty. I don't think we think about the kind of loyalty that would, say, drive Jadzia Dax to stand and fight to the death alongside her Klingon brothers, if you will, in order to appease justice.
Yeah, Klingons sort of carry loyalty to its logical conclusion,
oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah, you know, humans might say, "No, that's too far. You know, we're not gonna go out and kill for the sake of loyalty, right? That's going too far, right? You know, but Klingons, no, they take loyalty to its maximum extreme.
And why not? They're Klingons.
Exactly.
I think that's what it means to be a Klingon, to take it to the max, you know, to live Maz, as they say.
Klingons take it to the max. I love it. Whatever it is, loyalty, duty, honor,
blood
wine.
They are
blood wine to the max.
They are a meta species.
So let me try to, I like what we're doing here. We're trying to giving like a quasi-philosophical analysis of various virtues, Klingon virtues, right? Loyalty. What about the concept of honor? You know, of course, you know, humans have the idea of honor, but it means something different to Klingons. The thing that comes to my mind is that honor for Klingons is more wrapped up with family honor, right? Like Worf is dishonored if his father is dishonored, right? And family loyalty and family honor kind of rolls downhill for Klingons, right? Your individual honor is tied up with your family honor and your family name, right? It's almost this, you have Klingon houses that all have different social statuses and compete with each other. And so your individual honor is trumped by your family honor in some way. Even though there's a strong sense of individual honor and individual loyalty for Klingons, the family seems to have a greater priority than the individual. And that strikes me as an essential part of being a Klingon is not just being a Klingon, but being a Klingon, being a good representative of your family and your house.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's honor above life, according to Kern. And what does, you know, what does that mean in the Klingon Empire? What does honor mean to a Klingon?
Well, this is the idealized sense, I think, right? In Worf's mind, you should prioritize the family over the individual. You should prioritize the empire over the individual. You should be self-sacrificing for the sake of those things. But when you look at how other Klingons actually function, how many Klingons actually do sacrifice their own lives willingly for the sake of the empire or for the sake of their family, you see an awful lot of Klingons that are willing to make other trade-offs than being strictly loyal to their family or strictly loyal to the empire. I'm thinking of the Duras family, or thinking of just other examples where Klingons aren't just willing to raise their hand and say, "I'll go fight to the death," without blindly, without any consideration. You know, there's a tension between being life affirming in the moment and not being life affirming means I don't want to die right now, right? I'm going to drink my blood wine and have a good time, right? So there's a tension between that life affirming aspect of Klingon of the Klingon spirit and this loyalty to family or to the empire. But Worf seems to be the one who has this idealized, right? Are other Klingons, do they feel those senses as strongly as Worf, or is it all lip service?
Well, that's just it. I think it's true, with any culture. You know, you get politics, personal gain. These things get in the way. You mentioned the Duras sisters. I mean, it was about politics and personal gain for them. And that was certainly their motivation. Now, they could have twisted and morphed that into something that they called honorable, but in reality, it was very petty and self-serving, for them. So I think that's true in any culture.
Well, there's two ways you can read this, right? One way of reading it is that the Klingons you just mentioned, like the Duras sisters, right? Are they on worst view, they're just bad Klingons, right? they themselves don't understand Klingon virtues and Klingon ideals. And, you know, if they are conniving and manipulative and more Romulan-esque, right? Does that just make them bad Klingons? Or is Worf just wrong about the essence of being a Klingon?
Well, as it's pointed out to Worf many times, he is wrong generally about Klingons. However, I think that the Duras sisters represent what we come to understand is a cancer in the Empire. There is something intrinsically broken in the Empire. I mean, that's why Kalus was cloned to begin with. That's why in the Voyager episode Prophecy, mm-hmm. you know, that's why those Klingons kind of broke away from the Empire, going in search of their savior, mm-hmm. if you will. They're looking for this idealized Klingon that's going to set everything right in the Empire. There is something intrinsically broken in the Empire. And the Duras sisters are only a symptom of that brokenness. And for that matter, they come from a long line of crooked Klingons, don't they? I mean, every time, going all the way back to Enterprise, I mean, Duras, the original Duras, the quintessential Duras of Enterprise was you know, very self-motivated. And it seems that was, you know, certainly carried down the line, you know, to Lursa and Betor.
What's interesting, you mentioned the episode Prophecies from Voyager, and we run the risk of delving into Klingon theology here rather than focusing on Klingon virtue ethics. But what's interesting about that episode is the idea that there could be sort of a Klingon religion origin cult, right? You know, in some sense, the Klingons that you see in Prophecy, they've left the Klingon Empire to pursue a more idealized form of their religion. Maybe they go looking for a messianic figure, of course, right? But in some sense, it's an attempt to return to the foundations of Klingon beliefs that they think the Empire as a whole has strayed from. And you see this in other religions, right? Christianity has its origin cults and its origin movements, right? Returning to a more authentic, more original form of a religion. That's a well-known phenomenon. But, you know, can we learn anything about Klingon virtues or Klingon theology from the type of origin cult that you see in the episode Prophecy?
Well, again, I think it's a commentary of, you know, what happens here in our world when we see that level of corruption, and when things tend to go wrong in the world, as they often do. These things will sometimes drive people to seek a deeper spiritual understanding of, you know, whether it be Christianity or whatever. You know, they tend to turn towards religion, looking for answers or looking for clarity. So I think those Klingons were certainly typical of what you might have in a broken empire. You might have a group of Klingons kind of going off in search of that idealized Klingon, that virtuous savior that's going to set everything right.
And of course, this is the reason that the clone of Kalus is made emperor, right? I mean, this is an attempt to try to provide a new ideal and rally the troops, so to speak, right? Get all the Klingons on the same page to rally around their ideals and rally around an individual, because individuals do need some sort of an ideal to shoot for, and this is the role that Kalus plays, and it's presumably, you know, not in terms of the individual, but this is presumably what those Klingons in the episode Prophecy are looking for. They're looking for an ideal, right? That's why they're looking for the savior, the Kuva Mok, right? That's what they're out for. They're mm-hmm. looking for some sort of an ideal. And of course, with Kalus, it's kind of, it's farcical, right? Because it's, you know, it's not the real Kalus. It's a clone. We've observed already that even the clone of Kalus can't live up to Kalus, right? But the mere fact that there's a figurehead means that there's an ideal to shoot for. And you know, I think Worf's view by the end of the episode, and maybe Gowron's view practically coming around to it, is that, you know, the having an ideal is a powerful motivator, right? You want to have something to judge your actions by and judge the actions of other others by it rallies people together around an ideal or a cause. And Kayla seems to serve this role. It's more of a symbol of Klingon ideals than the reality of the situation. The reality of the situation, whether the individual, the clone of Kayla's, can live up to those ideals, just doesn't matter, right? The mere fact that there is a role and is a figure that fills that role and has this, you know, rich history surrounding Klingon morality and Klingon ideals, that matters much more than the reality of the situation.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, Mike, we've been talking for about an hour now on Klingon ideals. Do you want to bring this home with some final thoughts on Klingon virtue ethics?
Well, I thought it'd be a good idea, Zachary, if we would just mention a handful of episodes, maybe an essentials list of Klingon episodes in which our listeners might be able to explore the Klingon culture a little bit. And it's a great time because we're coming into the Thanksgiving holiday season and the Christmas holiday season. So as people are home celebrating the holidays, they might have an opportunity to watch some of these episodes. This certainly isn't a comprehensive list, just a list of essential episodes that they might be able to get a better understanding or a better idea of Klingon virtue ethics.
Well, Mike, I put together a list of TNG episodes as I prepared for our episode tonight. You know, for me, I went right back to Star Trek: The Next Generation because this is where you first start seeing Klingon culture developed in depth, right? Prior to the original series, there just wasn't a sense of who the Klingons really were. I forget how many episodes the Klingons actually appeared in the original series, but it wasn't very many. I mean, we're talking 4 or 5 episodes at mm-hmm. most. But it's really in Star Trek: The Next Generation that you get some rich backstory and a sense of Klingon culture, right? The Next Generation set the precedent for delving into the depths of Klingon culture. And of course, that's continued in Deep Space Nine and Enterprise and Voyager a little bit, but mostly Deep Space Nine and Enterprise. So I'll run through my list of TNG episodes. And then Mike, I know you put together a more comprehensive list from the other series, and if you could bring us home with the other episodes. And you mentioned Thanksgiving, right? You know, we're creeping up on Thanksgiving here as we're recording this. I wonder what Klingon Thanksgiving would really be like, right? You know, what kind of celebratory feasts would Klingon have? It wouldn't be roasted targ meat. What do they eat for Thanksgiving?
I think it would be roasted targ.
Burned replicated bird meat is not the Klingon delicacy.
Yeah, I think it would be targ with a side of gok.
Well, it's funny you mentioned, before we talk about this, it's funny you mentioned gok. Because it strikes me that even gok is symbolic of the Klingon spirit, right? Humans are gonna be disgusted by gok, right? Riker's disgusted when he has to eat live gok in the episode A Matter of Honor in TNG when he serves on the Klingon ship, the Pach. But Klingons, you know, Klingons are not gonna be intimidated by some worms wriggling around on their plate. You know, stabbing the live gok with a fork and shoving it down their throats is emblematic of the Klingon approach to life, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So I'm glad you mentioned gok. I actually thought of that as I was watching A Matter of Honor a couple days ago. That, yeah, Klingons eat gok with gusto, right? They do everything with gusto, but humans are going to be grossed out by gok. No other species in the Federation might really enjoy gok, at least not live. But Klingons take that fork and shove it down their throats, and that says something about the Klingon spirit.
Yeah, fistful of gok and a big cup of blood wine, heart of targ. Some Greypok sauce. Some war nog.
Thanksgiving at its finest.
Some war nog. Some rock.
Right.
Got to have some
Something
rock.
Tells me they don't go Black Friday shopping after Thanksgiving.
Fire wine.
Right. All right. Well, I'm going to run down my list of TNG Klingon episodes. Exactly. All right. I'm going to run down my list of TNG Klingon episodes. This is not a comprehensive list. These are just Zach's list of essential TNG Klingon episodes if you want to learn about the Klingon culture and Klingon virtues. So my list is Heart of Glory, A Matter of Honor, The Emissary, The Bonding, Sins of the Father, Reunion, Redemption 1 and 2, Birthright 1 and 2, and Firstborn. That is my list of essential Klingon virtue ethics episodes from TNG.
And those are great episodes, every last one of them. There are more from Deep Space Nine that I think are essential Klingon episodes, because we do see the Klingon species quite a bit more throughout the run of Deep Space Nine. Blood Oath comes to mind. I mentioned earlier on the podcast, House of Quark, I think, is a very interesting episode. Way of the Warrior, The Sword of Kalis, Sons of Moog, Rules of Engagement, Apocalypse Rising, Looking for Pamach in All the Wrong Places, Trials and Tribulations, Soldiers of the Empire, Sons and Daughters, You Are Cordially Invited, and by the way, you'll get a great Klingon history lesson as taught by Jadzia Dax, and not the, you know, not the cleaned up version of Klingon history, but the proper Klingon history. Once More Into the Breach, one of my favorite episodes of all times. From some of the other series, is Errand of Mercy from Klingon, or from rather from Star Trek, the original series. That's the first appearance of Klingons in Star Trek. Day of the Dove. From Voyager, Barge of the Dead. Day of Honor. Prophecy, Zachary and I both mentioned several times in the podcast today. From Enterprise, Broken Bow. Sleeping Dogs. Judgment. Marauders. Affliction. And Divergence. That's my essential list.
Well, Mike, have we made our case that Klingon virtue ethics is a distinctive type of ethics above and beyond the types of ethics that we talked about in Star Trek last week, the rule-based ethics that we see in Kantian ethics or in even in the Federation's approach to ethics, right? You know, the Prime Directive is an example of a rule-based ethics. Of course, you know, we see Sisko last week when we were talking about In the Pale Moonlight dealing with trying to maximize consequences and being willing to break the rules to maximize consequences. Have we made our case that Klingons have a distinctive approach to ethics that falls in the category of virtue ethics?
Yeah, I really think we have. In terms of kind of the rules-based set of ethics, yeah, there's certainly some rules I think the Klingons have. But at the end of the day, I think it is a matter of virtue ethics. I think it's a matter of, you know, personal honor, loyalty. You know, it is do whatever you have to do to bring honor to the Empire. That really is, I think, what drives a Klingon at the end of the day. And those Zachary, are my final thoughts.
Yeah, likewise. I think, you know, the Klingons have always been some of my favorite characters, and Worf in particular. You know, his combination of having high ideals, but also being really relatively stoic and relatively not grumpy. But, you know, Worf is sort of the practical voice of reason in the Next Generation, right? I mean, how many times does Worf get told no because he's seeking the cautious approach, right? We should fire phasers, we should put our shields up, and he gets some
fire phasers.
No, Worf, we can't do that.
Mr. Worf.
There's even a YouTube video someone put together where someone edited together all the many times that Worf gets told no in Star Trek: The Next Generation. It's amazing because he's always getting shut down, but yet most of the time Worf is right. Right, caution is the right approach in Worf's role as security chief. But so Worf's one of my favorite characters. You know, his stoicism and yet his sense of high ideals, even if other Klingons can't live up to it, and even if he himself can't live up to it, it's important to have ideals. And Worf really does embody for me the Klingon spirit. Even if he's the only Klingon who really does live up to it, he says something about the essence of Klingon nature to me. You know, for Klingons, there's kind of a paradox. You know, they are almost obsessed to a fault of having a good death and dying for the Empire. They have a strong sense of individual loyalty. There's a lot to be admired there. But the, you know, philosophically, the question for me is, you know, again, does virtue ethics is that a substantively different third category of ethics beyond the other types of ethics? What does it mean to be a virtuous Klingon? You know, as soon as you ask that question, what's the essence of Klingon nature? It's hard not to resort to talking about actions, right? What types of actions do Klingons do? Oh, well, they sacrifice themselves. They drink blood wine. You know, they sharpen they practice with holodeck monsters with their batleth, right? There's various things that Klingons do that typify what it means to be Klingon. And so when you're talking about Klingon virtue ethics, you have to ask the question, I think, does this mean that virtue ethics is really a distinctive type of ethics? Or when we're talking about Klingon virtues, does that just mean all the different types of actions that Klingons do? You know, philosophically, virtue ethics is a different category, right? If the, like Aristotle's focus on character is not a focus on the rightness or wrongness of individual actions. It's a focus on developing habits of action or developing these character traits like courage and wisdom and temperance and justice. So when you ask about Klingon virtues, you know, the essential character traits of being a Klingon, does that immediately just mean the various things that Klingons do, the various types of actions that typify being a Klingon, or is there really something substantively different about virtue ethics that makes it a non-action based types of ethics? So, you know, I guess my point is I still have philosophical questions. You know, I've been trying to use Klingons as an example of virtue ethics, but in general, I worry that virtue ethics just is reducible to one of the other categories of ethics and that it doesn't really add anything to the picture. I do think that you know, the emphasis of being in the middle is important from a virtue ethics standpoint for humans, at least. You know, I'm not a Klingon, I'm a human, right? So the emphasis on you know, staying in the middle ground, Aristotle's emphasis on the golden mean speaks a lot to me. And we mentioned this last week, that if you emphasize rules too much, you're not going to be a terribly compassionate individual, right? You're not going to have compassion. You're not going to make practical trade-offs when necessary. But if you focus on consequences too much, you might break rules left and right. So there's something, at least about being human, that's important about staying in the middle ground. But for Klingons, the middle ground is not where they live, right? Klingons take it to the max every single time. And that's an essential attribute of being a Klingon. So even if Klingons fall in the virtue ethics category, it seems like they do it in a different way than humans, right? The essential traits of being a Klingon, while there's some overlap, right? They're, you know, Klingons prioritize loyalty and humans think loyalty is important. But Klingons take those concepts to the max, I think, more than humans do. Humans tend to live a little more in the middle ground and find a balance, but balance is not the Klingon forte. So that's my final thoughts. I think Klingons do probably give a really good example of Klingon of virtue ethics as a philosophical theory, but they do it in their own way, right? And it would be fun to run this experiment with other races, right? You know, maybe down the road we can do a future episode on Vulcan virtue ethics or Ferengi virtue ethics. I would love to do Ferengi virtue ethics, actually.
Ferengi would be fun.
Ferengi ethics versus human virtue ethics.
Human.
So that's the situation as I see it. I think that you know, Klingons, even if they're a good example of virtue ethics, do it in their own way, and they take it to the max.
Klingons to the max.
That's my final thoughts.
Klingons to the max. I like it. Klingons to the max. All I have to say is I'm really glad that Worf was able to buy Nog's tooth sharpener. You know, so he could sharpen those teeth where he ground them down all the time when Captain Picard, now, Mr. Worf. Zachary, it's been fun talking about Klingon virtue ethics, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
They just happened to come at just the right time.
Right,
just the right time
for it to be dangerous.
Like, literally, like, not even like that day, but like 2 minutes before this happens.
Earl Grey.
Well, it does all those cloak experiments. It deployed that communications array.
Minefield?
And the minefield for exploratory purposes.
Let's not talk about the Defiant, because you know it's just going to upset me.
The Ready Room.
Here's one more thing I want to throw out here for you guys. Recasting this episode, because I know you guys like to do this on To the Journey with things, with mm-hmm. series and such. I think that Ma'ab should be played by Will Ferrell.
Yeah. To the Journey.
Okay, I know Tristan's gonna pick that one, and he's gonna pick that one, so I'm gonna pick this one.
Yeah, this one has a really nice B'Elanna moment, so I'm gonna leave that one for Tristan.
Right, you know, like, of course you pick it every time, and I know I can rely on you.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Now I feel like I have to see The Wicker Man to get all of the jokes that are in this movie.
Which one, the original or the remake?
Why would I watch anything with Nicolas Cage?
The 602 Club.
I remember hearing Timothy Zahn, even back then, reading an article that he was listening to the John Williams scores in his car as he was thinking all this through and making sure the pacing felt like it did with the music. So maybe it had to do with the certain music he was listening to. Maybe he was listening to a New Hope score at that point. I don't know.
Literary Treks.
I think we had between the three of us half a dozen or eight different springboards, and they were written in such a way that they could have gone to either ship and crew. It was like, you know, the Sagittarius encounters big blob in space, or Endeavor encounters derelict spacecraft. Or, I mean, I'm being real surface here. I mean, the prompts we provided in the Bible were probably just a couple of sentences long, and it was just meant to say these are the kinds of stories we're thinking about.
Women at Warp.
So we went in and pitched, and I have to say that was
one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. I have scrubbed in on brain surgery. It did not frighten me as much as waiting outside Gene Roddenberry's office getting ready to go in and pitch to him.
Meta Trex.
That would have just been a grand moment if, George Takei would have played Tuvix, and when the transporter accident happens, he's standing there in those colorful clothes and just says, oh my.
Oh my.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these and other shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, hey, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you there. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many more. Hey, we really appreciate any support that you can give us. It costs a lot of money to put these podcasts out, and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission.
If you'd like to contact us to give us feedback or suggestions for the show, you can do so in many different ways. One way is to contact us via the contact form on Trek.fm's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail, look at the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trek.fm.
On Twitter, you can reach us under the username @trek.fm.
You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/trek.fm. Also on the Babel Conference, type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. The Babel Conference is a closed group, but if you ask to join, we'll let you right in. You can join in on the discussion.
If you have a spare moment, we also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show, and leaving a rating and review helps other listeners on iTunes find our show.
Zachary, would you like to tell our listeners where they can find you on the interwebs?
You can find me and all the other Trek FM hosts on the Babel Conference user group. Again, just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search bar and you'll find the Babel Conference. But you can also find me on Twitter, and my handle there is just my name. That's Zachary Fruhling, ZacharyFruhling. So Twitter is probably the best place to find me on the interwebs. And Mike, where can they find you on the interwebs these days?
Yeah, you can find me at Facebook through the Babel Conference. I'm also on Twitter. My username is @cmichael1701. Zachary, there's a few people we want to thank before we close the show today. We want to acknowledge C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Charlene Smith, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, our art director, Aaron Harvey, Will Nguyen, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our wonderful editor and producer. So thanks again for listening to MetaTrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before. Speaking of Klingon pants, I always thought the Klingon pants in the original series looked really scratchy. They're like sandpaper, man. It's like, they couldn't ambush you because you'd hear ksh, ksh, ksh. right. coming at you, you know. Yep. You just knew they were coming.
I thought the most uncomfortable looking thing was the metallic sheets and the metallic pillows they use on Next Generation.
Oh, yes.
Yes. That doesn't look comfy at all, little threads of metal woven throughout your fabric.
No, because after a 12-hour shift in engineering, you do not want to go to your quarters and lay down on that pillow and pull that piece of tinfoil up over you. Ah, my bed.
Right. Curl up in a comfortable bed of aluminum foil.
Yeah.